right, we've got a lively crew here this morning. Welcome to our discussion on the Gen Z economy. My name is Eric Miller. I will be the moderator today and your host with four wonderful panelists. So here's how it's going to work this morning. I'm going to have each panelist introduce themselves as way of background, and each panelist must share a fun fact. By the way, something that the rest of us would never expect about you. Maybe we have royalty here or something. Who knows? And then I'll introduce myself quickly as well. And it's all about a discussion of this next upcoming generation, right? The Gen Z. Raise your hand if you're Gen Zer. I think this whole crew back here. Yeah? Maybe? Kind of, sort of. All right, Gen Zers in the house. I love it. And so the way this works, I've got a quick announcement for those of you that have attended other events. You probably have heard this, but I do have to set the expectation around how we'll interact with each other. So in this CWA session, we will utilize both the CWA app. So if you haven't downloaded the app, you may want to do that. It's the most convenient way to be able to pose questions to our panelists. And a note card system to receive questions from all of you. To ask a question in the app, simply select this session in the schedule, tap Q&A, and then insert and send your question. So I'll be using the app throughout our session and posing your questions in that regard. You may also raise your hand and request a note card and pencil from one of our producers. I think Charlene is our producer today. She's in the back. Raise your hand, Charlene. All right. Charlene will go around and give you a note card as well. So you must write legibly, please. And if you're a student or attending remotely, please note this in your question. Make your questions brief and to the point. So with that, let's jump into introductions by our panelists. We're going to start in the middle here with Lux, who is an author. I'm just going to let Lux has a fascinating background. I'm going to let her jump in. And don't forget your fun fact, Lux.
I would never. And also, do you want me to do my opening statement as well, or just a quick intro?
I think let's do opening statements as well. And then
great. So I am Lux. My TLDR bio is that I'm a writer who focuses on sex, feminism, and pop culture. My much, much longer bio is that I have worked in sex and sex education from a variety of capacities over the past over 20 years. I've been a sex educator. I have worked in the adult industry. I have worked as a journalist covering the adult industry. I've done consulting for sex toy companies and other sex tech companies. These days, I mostly am a freelance writer and a columnist at One Zero, which is Medium's tech publication, and also I do some consulting, and as he mentioned, I am an author, and my book, Faking It, The Lies Women Tell About Sex and the Truths They Reveal, is available for sale at Mackie. Please pick it up, or you can buy it as an ebook or an audiobook or wherever you buy books. And my fun fact is that I'm not exactly royalty, but I did live in Boulder as a toddler. That's not the fun fact. It gets better. My parents did their postdocs at CU Boulder, and in the final year, in the final weeks, I think, of my stay here as a three-year-old, I was scouted on the street and became a cover model for a visitor information pamphlet. I've tweeted out the photo. I'm going to retweet it, so if you go to my Twitter, which is just my name, you will see a photo of a three-year-old me eating chocolate ice cream. Not exactly royalty, but, you know, by Boulder standards. So talking about Gen Z and talking about the economy, as I mentioned, I have a lot of background in sex and sex tech and the adult industry. And I would love to approach this topic by talking a little bit about how the adult industry has evolved over the past 20 years, i.e. the lifespan of a Gen Zer. If we go back 20 years, which is kind of the early days of online porn, and the beginning of a shift from the adult industry being an analog medium where you're buying magazines, you're buying videos, you're renting, you're going out into the world to access this content, to content that you can access from the privacy of your home on your computer. That was a huge shift, because now suddenly, in the same way that going from pornography in theaters to going to pornography that you could rent from the not Blockbuster, but rent from your local video store and watch at home, that made it a much more private experience. Suddenly now you didn't even have to leave your house. You could just go to your computer, access this content, access it privately. That meant a lot more people felt comfortable accessing it, and that meant a lot more money was going into it. So in the late 90s, early 2000s, you had this period where, while there was the high barrier to entry in terms of stigma, because if you became a pornographer, that might affect your life in some ways, there was a really, really low barrier to making a lot of money. Because if you put content online and you market it well enough, you would get an audience. There was actually a whole period where you didn't even have to make original content. You could just acquire content from someone else that may be appearing elsewhere, package it on your site, and maybe say, like, oh, well, I hand-selected these photos for women, and make a lot of money. That was a period that lasted throughout about the early aughts, but we're going to jump now to 2009. So 10 years ago, when Gen Zers were, in elementary school, maybe entering into middle school, the oldest of the Gen Zers at least, now you have a really precipitous change in how the adult industry works, because you have the introduction of what are often referred to as tube sites. So I'm talking something like Pornhub, YouPorn, Xhamster, whatever. These sites that were basically like a YouTube-type site, but full of pirated porn. So consumers now say, wow, if I want to watch porn, not only do I not have to leave my house, but I don't even have to take out my credit card, because I can go to these sites. There are seemingly endless porn clips. There's all variety, all the performers that I want to see. It's free. I don't have to worry about payment. I don't have to deal with the shame of, like, oh, no, I'm paying for porn. For producers, however, this was calamitous, because, as I said, these sites were driven by piracy, so that meant that the people who were actually producing the content were seeing their content stolen and distributed for free, which meant within the adult industry, a lot of the major players started collapsing. You had to work twice as hard for half as much money. You saw a lot of people going out of business, a huge shift in how the industry was working. Now we're going to fast forward to today, 2019. We have a wildly different industry, because what we have is a company called MindGeek, which is the owner of Pornhub and YouPorn, and actually the owner of a lot of big names that used to be independent, like Digital Playground used to be a major player and an independent company and is now owned by MindGeek. And MindGeek has a monopoly over the adult industry. Again, they still primarily traffic in free porn, some of which is still pirated, although since they own a lot of the companies, it becomes a little bit more of a gray area. But they are the major player in the adult industry. Don't ask me how they make money, because I suspect it is not legal. But, they are really monopolizing the industry. And if, aside from that, if you have that as the major player in the adult industry, most people end up having to work for them in some capacity. Aside from that, what you have are really small niche properties that are rethinking what it means to get people to pay for adult content. It used to be, again, back in 1999, you could just set up shop. You didn't even have to have original photos. You just say, hey, pay money, you'll see porn, and people would pay money. Now, however, you have a shift where people assume that pornography is free, and if you want to get them to pay money, you have to do an added incentive. Now, sometimes that added incentive is by creating content that is very unique and very specialized, and maybe is, it's queer, or it's made by women for women, or whatever. There's some extra special thing where it's saying, you're not going to find this on the piracy-driven sites. This is not the quote-unquote mainstream content. But What is even more interesting to me is that some of the newer sites now are either literally crowdfunding or mimicking the language of crowdfunding as they set up what are functionally just pay sites. So what you see now is, instead of just saying, hey, I made porn, you want it, pay me money, you're seeing these statements that are around, porn costs money to make. If you like this porn, if you like what we're doing, please consider contributing. Instead of, you'll go to what are effectively, again, pay sites, and instead of seeing join, you'll now see support us. And you'll see the ask now being positioned in a much more personal way, being positioned in a way that is really highlighting the fact that it costs money to create content, and that if people want that content to exist, they need to financially support it. Now, I know that I have opened by talking about pornography, partly because it's my background and partly because it tends to get people's attention. But I want to shift a little bit and go more broadly.
So, Lux,
Am I running out of time? Sorry.
No better attention-grabby way to start a session than on pornography.
Let me just quickly say, we'll go to someone else. Sorry to monopolize time. What I just want to say is that dynamic that we're seeing as we shift from analog to digital to nobody pays for digital to these pleas for money, that's happening in journalism, that's happening in music, that's happening in many, many industries. So sorry for going long.
Fantastic. No, thanks so much for kicking off our discussion here. And, you know, quite a little shift here. We're going to go from pornography now to camel feed. And I'm thrilled to have Tiasha here, who so generously jumped in to share her thoughts on our panel. She's the founder of Proto Camel, and allow her to introduce herself real quick.
Thank you for inviting me here. Basically, I just want to say that I'm probably here because I'm the youngest. I'm not the Gen Z generation, but I'm the young millennial. And maybe it's not such a big shift, because the funny fact about my company is that we are producing also Camel Viagra. So not such a big shift. I wanted to talk from my perspective. I was raised in a spirit that you have to go to school, you have to go to college, you have to have good grades, then you will get a job, a good job, and then you will stay in that job for another 40 years. And I think that young generation today don't see that, or don't feel that, or they don't see that kind of a jobs because they're not there. It's business, it's mobile jobs, it's freelancing, it's very different than it was for our parents, because for me, I went to college. I was top 5% of the best students in my college. I had good grades. I did some researches. I got my bachelor and two masters, and now it was from educational sciences, nothing from biology or stuff like that. And now I'm coming from a country that has 6 camels, and I founded a company that's producing camel feed for racing camels, and we're selling it to Arab world. So this is a big shift, and this is a shift that is happening to everyone, almost everyone, into this young generation. And the problem is that as my supportive system was not ready for this, my parents, my friends, my college, it was not ready to support young millennials or Gen Z generation how to shift from jobs like that into freelancing, into business. I think it's also supportive system here not ready for youngsters to go through this. So I will... This is my statement for now. I will talk about it more later.
Fantastic. Thanks so much, Tiasha. And was your... round of applause, yeah. Was your fun fact the camel Viagra, or was there a different fun fact that
I think
you
my whole bio is a fun fact.
Well said. Thanks so much. And now I'm super thrilled to introduce Mattia, who's going to share a little bit of his background. What a fascinating background in creating school systems and in being an entrepreneur. And I'll allow Mattia to expand a little bit more on his background for us now.
Wow, Eric, and isn't this like the most insane panel you could possibly three girls, like,
just wait till you get to me. We have black holes is what I'm doing.
That's what I'm saying. Like you said, my background is mainly education, and that's why I'm also super thrilled that there is a group of high schoolers back there. Shout out. What I do essentially is I run a program that helps youngsters, high schoolers mainly, earn a living by doing what they love. And the way we do this is we run a network of accelerator programs in high schools where we bring entrepreneurs into schools with the very explicit point, get them to turn a passion into a business. And there's a curriculum behind it, and this has expanded pretty much all over Eastern Europe, and the recent addition to our family of countries has been Mexico. But I'd like to basically not spend a lot of time on advertising about me, but more talking about the guys there in the corner, because I think there is this really interesting shift happening. And I'd like to provoke this discussion with two statements directly correlating with the previous two panelists have said. What happens when you have somebody with two masters and then she decides to do camel feet? What happens when you have porn stars that do not have any more money? Well, for me, I think the two statements that need to be said is, number one, the generation that is growing up right now is the most privileged generation in the history of humanity. It's a bold statement, but I firmly believe it is true, because people have more or less food on the table. People have more or less roof above their heads. And more importantly, even than that, people have free time. None of that happened to such an extent 100 or maybe even 200 years ago. Stuff can happen. And the second fact, which is I think even more profoundly shocking, especially for the, let's say, slightly older people here in the front, is for the first time in history, we have a situation where the young generation is actually teaching the older generation how to cope with the world. What do I mean by that? Probably you guys in the front are asking your children or your grandchildren how to use the computer. With that being said, we are now in front of a very serious dilemma, where we have a young generation that is poised to do great things, that is very capable to take over this planet, in good or bad. But this generation that is still somehow being pushed to the side because the authorities in their lives have forever been telling them what Tiasha has explained. You should do this, you should have good grades, you should get the extracurriculars, you should go to college, you should get huge debt so that you will actually graduate. And then all the authorities who have said all the things with the nicest of intentions have been wrong and have been proven wrong, where schooling and these insights and these suggestions have fallen to deaf ears and have been mainly made obsolete by situations like, for example, the cool anecdote I always like to use is a student from one of our program that has decided to actually make money by making Pokemon costumes for people who go to Pokemon conventions. You can imagine how much the parents have told that girl that she should start doing something serious. Well, the funny thing is that that girl made much more money than both of the parents combined, because something really interesting happened about a year and a half ago, which is called Pokemon Go. And all of a sudden, a lot of people really wanted those damn costumes. So, in order to make this debate a bit more provocative, I would like to say that yes, there is a slight struggle, the young generation versus the old. And something really interesting is going to happen. And I don't know exactly what, but it's going to be damn fun.
And, yeah, round of applause. Thanks, Mattia. Wow. I don't think we could have a more diverse panel here. Yeah, that's true. Thanks, Michelle. So, fun fact
to you. I have a Master of Arts in Applied Imagination.
Ooh. Ooh. Ooh, I like applied that. Imagination. Fantastic. And then lastly, we've got Michelle here, who also graciously jumped in to share her thoughts. She's an assistant director at NASA. And so what a just fascinating different perspectives that we have. So Michelle, please introduce yourself and share a few opening words.
Great to be here. Yeah, so my name is Dr. Michelle Thaler. I'm an astrophysicist at NASA, and I've had somewhat of an unusual career at NASA because I started out as sort of a regular research scientist. I was working at Caltech on my postdoctoral research fellowship, and at that time, NASA started to get interested in doing communication, and doing organized communication, public education, things like that, and they really didn't know what they were doing, so they sort of just gave it to a postdoc and said, here, you know, just come up with an education system for our telescope, but I know, with no background in education or anything, and they gave me $1 million a year and said, go. And so I've had to kind of learn on the fly about how you put together a public education system and also you know, reach the public. The way that that NASA especially and the federal government is communicating now is changing so fast. Even in the last 5 years, we've stopped doing traditional press conferences largely because we had only like maybe 10 reporters would come. You know, the New York Times would call in. We'd have our panel of scientists behind a table like this talking into microphones. And we just weren't getting much of an audience. I mean, now we do everything on Facebook Live and Instagram. I've gotten very good at Snapchatting press conferences because you have to have them in 10-second segments, which is really kind of interesting. And the change in our audience reach, especially to young people, you know, typically now for a very good result, we're looking at a social media footprint in the billions or tens of billions. And that means, I mean, there's not 10 billion people in the world, but it means people keep coming back again and again. And yesterday, my life was just slammed by this black hole result. I spent all day on social media, and specifically on social media. I spent all day on Instagram and Twitch and Facebook and Twitter. And so, you know, it's really sort of a very different way for scientists to reach the public. I am the host of two television shows for the Discovery Channel, and I do a podcast for the NPR, National Public Radio. I have never been paid a penny for any of that. We are entering this sort of new idea of this kind of gig economy where if you get exposure, that's what you're paid in. And this is something that's a really interesting thing for artists and for musicians and for people that are, you know, in all aspects of the arts as well, that people often say to me, you know, how do I get a job, you know, being a television scientist? And it's like, well, you get your doctorate, go work for NASA, and then do it for free. And then, I mean, and that is actually how you do it. That there are very few exceptions to that these days. What it has gotten me are things like book deals and, you know, and speaker tours and stuff that's very good, doesn't pay my salary. The young people I work with at NASA are very, very used to this idea of the gig economy, of taking things that are just going to be a short-term job, getting expertise, and then going on to something very quickly. And this is another kind of seismic shift in the way that a government science organization runs. It used to be that if you're an engineer at NASA, you enter right out of, you know, undergrad or graduate school, and then you become a civil servant, a government employee, and you just keep on going until you retire at 65 on a pension. They got rid of our pensions a long time ago, by the way, in the government. You know, nowadays, you know, we're much more ready and okay with the fact that you don't have that guarantee. You have to come with the skill that's needed, and you will be working at NASA for as long as that skill is needed. And it's up to you to sort of keep abreast of that. Mm-hmm. And it's not that you can't do that as you age. It's a different way of thinking about it. My husband is 63 years old and is fought over by NASA missions because he has a specialty in quantum optics that nobody else can do. And we actively look for these people. You know, what can you do that no one else can do? It's not a career path anymore. It's very, very individual based. And it's all about personal connections and people finding out how, you know, that you have this skill and then building those teams. At NASA Goddard Space Flight Center, where I work, it's a 10,000 person NASA base. And it used to be that we had separate campuses. You know, it's as big as the University of Colorado, not in terms of people, but in terms of how spread out it is. And you know, we had an engineering campus and a science campus. And now we're building buildings specifically for integrated teams. Breakdown down those two cultural divides, have people working together in small groups, mainly our young people are on those teams. So I guess, you know, I've seen a big transition in communication and the idea of doing short-term jobs, you know, very quickly moving on. If anybody wants to talk about commercial space flight, this is a little older. I mean, you know, Elon Musk is not exactly a Generation Y person, but you know, we're working more and more with commercial space flight, small satellites, things that can be done quickly. Even college students and high school students can make really interesting scientific discoveries these days based on these smaller things. So I can talk about sort of that aspect of the science thing. So it's my fun fact. I know a better fact about Lux than you said. So I will tell you a fun fact. But we were on a panel. You did roller derby.
Oh yeah, there's that one too. I just wanted to tie it to Boulder.
I just think that's so cool. Yeah, that's right. So she said you did roller derby before it was kind of fashionable. So.
I was an original member of Gotham Girls Excellent. Roller Derby from like 04 to 07.
Yeah, I'm trying to think about my my little fact. I mean, for those of you, does anybody know the webcomic called The Oatmeal and Exploding Kittens? Yeah. Okay. So I am Matt Inman's science advisor. Whenever he needs anything, any question about how a kitten could explode, or he was just trying to recently figure out how kitten poop could change the climate of Mars and stuff. So I mean just yesterday I was talking to Matt about the black hole thing. So I am exploding kittens and the oatmeal science advisor.
Can I just address something that Michelle said? Because I think it's really interesting talking about the gig economy and specifically talking about young people. I'm a freelancer. I've been a freelancer full-time for 5 years, and I love it, and I think there's a lot to recommend about it. I think there's a lot of beautiful things about not being tied to an employer. However, there is a huge, huge problem when you are doing the gig economy in the U.S. specifically, which is that we have a country that is set up with the understanding that you will have an employer who takes care of your basic human needs. Yes. If I used to pay for my own health insurance, I got domestic partnered so that I could get on someone else's health insurance because it was getting to the point where my health insurance was going to be like $600 or $700 a month with a $7,000 deductible and no doctors who would take it. What we're seeing, I think, with the young, certainly my generation and millennials and younger millennials, and I think with Gen Z, we're seeing now a push towards socialism, a push towards a demand for a more robust social safety net, because there is this realization that you cannot have a gig economy and also no social safety net. If you want to say you're not going to be guaranteed to have a job for 40 years, you're not going to guarantee to have this paternalistic employer who gives you all the benefits, you have to have that coming from somewhere. Otherwise, you have pregnant women driving lifts in their ninth month, which is unacceptable.
Yeah. And I think this is, definitely clap it up. And this is just the moment to maybe be a little bit of a provocateur and say, my dear American friends, what the hell? This is something that we in Europe know for ages. But on a more serious note, since, again, addressing the corner of the youngsters back there, what do we do about it? I mean, probably you're here to learn about some potential answers. And one thing that I would like to tell you guys specifically about the gig economy is the very simple thing that jobs right now in today's world are getting less and less available, in a sense that somebody creates them and then you apply to them, but instead jobs are now becoming more and more invented. And that means that the two or three teachers in this room should be very much aware that they should be encouraging people to think for themselves, to use Google as much as possible. No, it's not called cheating if you look something up online. And much more importantly, that you're able to be a little bit of a more aggressive person when you're selling yourself. When you know that you're good at something, you should basically say, hey, this is what I'm good at, this is what I want to do, and then specialize in that. And that requires you to go above and beyond what you learn in school. This isn't an argument saying school is bad. This is saying that school is not enough. And that means that you guys, in order to survive in this day and age, very simply, there is a series of skill sets. For example, being able to sell yourself, being able to write a good cover letter, being able to come up with a project that an employer might be interesting. Because probably, and this is maybe a question to you now, it wasn't specifically NASA who told you, do the TV show. You wanted it, and then it was a collaboration effort when the job was defined.
I have not had a job that I applied for with an application. Here's the job, here's the description, please send us an application. I haven't done that since I got my postdoctoral research fellow in 1997. Every single job I've had, every single one, was when I defined myself and went out and got myself and got them to write the job description specifically for me. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, this is exactly how it's done these days. The idea that when you're a scientist, I mean, you talked about writing. This is something I have to really, really emphasize. As a scientist in the government, your salary is really not covered. I mean, what you have is a hunting license for certain types of grants. And we need to win our money. Absolutely. This is how science works these days. I mean, being a professor, I think, is a lot slower these days, that you're really judged by how much money you bring into the organization. So, you know, there are, you know, calls from the National Science Federation or from NASA or from, you know, the European Space Agency, and you apply for those, and that funds your time to do your research, do your job. That's where my salary comes from. So, you know, the idea that as a scientist, what I mainly do is write. You know, I mainly write proposals, and I have had so, now at NASA, I'm actually on the committees that give out billions of dollars. And, you know, specifically, we'll actually have missions that are, you know, $2 or $3 billion missions that we're going to fund, missions to Mars or, you know, the new space telescope. I have read so many badly written proposals. Knowing how to have a narrative and a clear idea and how to write that and how to speak that becomes an incredibly important skill today.
Mm-hmm. Can I jump in?
Yeah, well, I was just going to say, this is the easiest moderator job I've ever had to do. I just sit here and, yeah, take notes and listen. Yes, please, Tiasha, jump in.
Yeah, so I want to say that, as Mattia said, I totally agree that today there are not jobs out there available, but you have to create them by yourself. So this is kind of a freelancing, what Luke said. And as I said before, that we do not have a good supportive system, I meant by parents not understanding that and teaching that, by school system and teachers not understanding that and teaching that, because you have to be damn innovative to do that, because you cannot go like this if you have to create your own job. But Lux also said that she loves freelancing, but that is one thing that she's kind of afraid of, like healthcare system and stuff like that. Well, this is the thing that I'm not afraid in my country. I am a freelancer. Although I founded a company, I'm not full-time employed in my company. I still do other projects. I do a lot of remote working. I travel a lot and so on. But I'm not afraid of freelancing because I know with my social system in my country, I will never be poor or fell on the ground, because we pay taxes and we have healthcare system that is free. You have your doctor, you have your dentist, you will always be accepted. We have a school system that is free. Anyone can apply into college at any age, at any time. So our social system is providing us to be safe while freelancing.
In Slovenia.
All from, Europe is like that.
From Slovenia, yeah.
I'm from Slovenia.
Slovenia. So I'll jump in here real quick, and we'll start getting to questions. And by way of background real quick, three things that define what I add to the discussion here today. Like I said, I've got the easiest moderator job in the world facilitating this. But one is, as a teacher, as Michelle mentioned, I'm a professor over at the Leeds School of Business. I've been teaching for about 15 years, and I teach entrepreneurship. So I teach about how to be in the gig economy and how to monetize your passion. Second is as a founder. So I founded 5 ventures over the last 30 years. Some have been successful, and we've IPO'd, and some have been absolute total flaming failures, and I've learned a lot along the way. And then perhaps most relevant is as a dad. So as I was prepping for our discussion today, I didn't realize that my 2 kiddos are Gen Z. And I got a little nervous, as I'm like, oh, my God, look what I'm up for as these kids get older, with the shift between the different generations. So I thought I'd just pause real quick and set context as well, and then we're going to jump in. We've got a number of really interesting questions that I'll pose to our guests here. But today is all about the Gen Z economy, and how are things gonna shift? Oh, sorry, my fun fact. My fun fact doesn't have to do anything with camels or other elements here, but I have 11 brothers and sisters.
Whoa.
Yeah, there's, and for those of you that are wondering, yes, we were Roman Catholic. So that certainly defined me the most. I was that kid that was selling lemonade when I was 5 years old and, was always resourcing, whatever I needed as I went about life. So with that, we're talking about Gen Z, and as a reminder, baby boomers, born up to 1964, about 80 million, right, and have really affected the economy over the last 25 years. Gen X, which I'm a member of, 51 million. Folks in that generation. And then we had the millennials, Gen Y, born up to roughly around 1980, up until about 2000, which is about 83 million, which is really driving the economy right now. And then Gen Z were born roughly 1997 to 2012. And I was reading a Forbes article last night, and they're saying that Gen Z will be the largest cohort by 2034, peaking at nearly 80 million people, and they will be the greatest force of change that our economy has ever seen, especially what Mattia had mentioned, based on the fact that they're a generation that has been pretty well established and I don't want to say well off, but generation that has been provided for and has a lot of time to create in the world. So I just wanted to set that context. This generation in the back of the room will be driving the bus on our planet very shortly, and so it's very interesting to look ahead to see how will they shift what day-to-day life is. All right, so we've got some really interesting questions that I'll tee up for our crew here. Students always get priorities, so for students that want to jump in, feel free to do that. We have a student question right here. How do you think this generational switch to make your passion your career has influenced young people, both positively and negative? So the shift of really going after your thank you, Charlene, going after your passion, how will that shift kind of day-to-day life? And maybe, Mattia, why don't you tee that one up for us initially from your background in being an educator?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think also probably the most relevant one for this discussion. In essence, it's good and bad. The good thing is that, yes, in theory, you can do whatever you want. For example, there's a student in our program who told his parents, I will only do what's fun in my life. And then I asked him what fun is, and his answer was 9-gag.
Now,
the girls in the back are going to start laughing. 9-gag is basically the shitstorm of the internet. It's this website where anyone can post anything, but the site has more views than New York Times. What he wanted to do was to take something, post it there, get so much likes that it would get on the homepage. That requires about 30,000 likes in one day. He kept at it, did it for one whole year. Every single night he would post something. And then about a year later, he posted a green t-shirt with a picture of Yao Ming. Believe it or not, the young generation calls this the big please meme, whatever, I don't know. Anyways, posts the t-shirt, wakes up next morning, he gets about 40,000 likes and about 3,000 comments, can I buy this t-shirt, it's really cool. What ended up happening was he went on Shopify, made a free website, connected to PayPal, started getting orders for the shirts, even though he hadn't even made one. Wakes up next morning with 36,000 orders, and he sold one t-shirt for $25. Moral of the story, this can happen, and this does happen. However, this only happens in about 5% of the cases of all the people, and it's not because of luck, but it's because of perseverance. What this guy did was he spent every single night posting something and doing it over and over and over and learning about the world, learning about the 9-gag situation, learning about what needed to be done for him to achieve in that. And here comes the bad part, the negative part, the part that probably the parents here in this room know very well. This world is really, really good for people to procrastinate. There is so much stuff out there that you can consume, that you can do, that you can, that you can let go your mind into this. That what ends up happening is that the choice becomes a bit of a burden and you end up doing nothing. And you get very divergent. You have a lot of cool creative ideas, but the execution part kind of sucks. And the real problem is that the young generation has been given so much bad advice that inherently they do not believe the old generation where they give advice, so they rebel. So now we have either two situations happening for the youngsters. Either they conform, become hardworking, but then become a little bit passive and a little bit afraid and are not used to the gig economy and are not really super happy. Or they might go completely in the other direction. They rebel. They have a lot of crazy ideas. But because they have no structure in their life, they don't execute on anything. And again, they have a problem. And I think this is the fundamental reason why we have such high rates of youth unemployment. And this is also something that does need to be, you know, acknowledged. How to fix this? Well, for the kids, be aware that the parents were right when they told you that you should get your shit done. For the parents, be even more aware that the kids do need their freedom, but that freedom must come in measured ways. And I'm not a parent, so I'm not going to presume to give parenting advice, but probably an honest conversation that will reestablish the trust between the old generation and the young one, well, that probably will help.
So I just want to build off of that. Are people... I don't know how many of you are familiar with the term survivorship bias, but I'm going to just give a brief, brief definition. Survivorship bias is basically... the people who succeed, the people who survive, have a sense of the path that they took to get to their success, to get to their survival, what have you, and they assume that the steps that they took are the steps that would lead anyone to their position, when in fact there are many people who've done the exact same thing and didn't end up there. So I do disagree a little bit on the luck thing, because I think oftentimes there is a lot of luck, and I think that as we move to the gig economy, as we move to like the influencer economy, there is this really big problem of people not being aware of survivorship bias. And so we see, like, oh, how did... I honestly don't know Instagram influencers, but how did some Instagram influencer with 1 million followers get this? And they'll be like, well, I just posted every day, and I did this, and I did that. And there's often, you know, other things. There's often some amount of luck. There's often maybe they had some connections. They had this. And that you, some person in Boulder who's 15 now, is not necessarily going to have the same effect. And I have seen this over my career when blog to book was a big thing, or Tumblr to book. Like, certain people would get book deals, and you'd be like, ooh, I'm just going to do exactly what they did, and then I'm going to get the book deal. And that didn't always happen. And sometimes it didn't happen because you did not work as hard as they did. And sometimes it didn't happen because lightning just didn't strike in the weird way where suddenly they ended up with a million followers. There is a person in journalism who is a little bit controversial within the New York media community. Her name is Lauren Duca. You may have heard of her. She really gained a lot of fame after the 2016 election. She was at the time a writer for Teen Vogue. She wrote a piece called Donald Trump is Gaslighting America. That piece went viral in part because people were surprised that Teen Vogue was doing something like this. She went on Tucker Carlson. Tucker Carlson yelled at her. And then suddenly, like, she had a book deal. She got all these prestigious speaking gigs. She's now very well placed, has like 300,000 Twitter followers, whatever, gets invited all these places, is the adjunct at NYU. However, one of the things that's been brought up by many people is Lauren Duca's piece was written, not her specific piece, but the concept and indeed that exact phrase, Donald Trump is gaslighting America, had been written before by many other people, and it appeared in many other publications. And it wasn't that she was the best and the smartest and that she had worked hardest. It was, again, this confluence of factors where people were shocked that it was Teen Vogue, where people were like, oh, this is interesting. And that rocketed her to fame. And so, you know, if I go and say, I will sometimes joke about, like, oh, I want my Lauren Duca moment. Like, I'll go on Fox News. Like, I'll get yelled at by Tucker Carlson. But lots of people go on Fox News and get yelled at by Tucker Carlson and don't get that fame, don't get that path to success. And I think that's the really scary thing about the gig economy and about this influencer economy is there is no guaranteed path. And that's something that I think we're going to really be contending
with. Let me jump in and
I won't jump in. Sorry. Not okay. Really, you had your turn.
A Slovenian battle.
Yeah. We're friends, we know each other, so this is nothing bad.
Definitely.
Okay, I just want to start here with a story of my friend. So, yes, the passion is not something you just, I think follow your passion thing is people think you're just waking up one day with your passion and then you go on the internet, find a job, apply to it, and next week you have it. It doesn't go that way. You have to work. And again, on the other hand, some of the passions are the ones that you will never achieve them because you don't have the predispositions for achieving them. And this where comes the story of my friend relevant. My friend had a dream that he will be a professional volleyball player. He was really, really good, working hard, working every day, going on trainings, but he was too short. There is no way he can be a professional volleyball player. So he applied for college. He was still persistent in volleyball, still played volleyball, started playing beach volleyball, where you can actually be shorter. And now he is a professional volleyball trainer. So this happened in the way. He was persistent. He was working. He was working to get there for years. He still followed his passion, but in that passion, he found a job or a position that's still in the field he loves, but he had to work hard to find it, and now he's working like a volleyball coach. So he's passionate, he's happy, he's making money doing that, and he's living his dream not being a volleyball player.
Yes.
So I think this is what people need to know today.
Precisely, and that's exactly what I wanted to say. And this is also where I think, respectfully, where Lux's argument about luck falls apart. It's not about luck. Of course you cannot say this will be the end goal and everyone will achieve the end goal. Yeah. I'm too skinny to be a center in NBA, although I am tall enough. But to that point, the story here is you need to learn persistence, perseverance, self-discipline, and salesmanship. When you know that, then you will be in a position to achieve something that you will create happiness. We are not talking here about the very peak, about exploding on Instagram, getting 2 million followers. That indeed has elements of luck, elements of, you know, hitting it to it. But if we put the bar to a very reasonable standard of achieving enough for a happy livelihood, then I am firmly of the opinion that everyone can achieve that and luck doesn't really play a factor under the condition that school was done right, parenting was done right, and social security was done right.
I would agree with that. I was definitely talking about luck in terms of like high, like celebrity, which so many people are like, I'm going to be that. Anyway.
So I think great transition to a topic that a number of students have asked here. And why don't we tee it up with you, Michelle, to start off with. The question is around education. So we're talking about what it takes to be successful moving forward in this generation. And the question is around the thread. There's three or four of them around this thread. So how does the education system, including higher ed, obviously where we are today, how does the education system need to change to cater to the Gen Z folks coming up to best prepare them for this next economy? So what are your initial thoughts on that, Michelle?
I'll make a brief statement, but I'm actually going to kick it off to my colleagues that are more experts in education than I am, because I'm sure they have something better to say. I know for myself, one of the things that I've really, really fought against is the standardization of education in the United States. It used to be, 20 years ago, I would be invited to be a guest speaker. I was at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. I was a young astronomer then, and I would go out to the public schools, schools that were a majority Latino, Spanish-speaking, wonderful schools, and I would have a chance to interact with the students. And then what changed was the state standards for California in the public schools demanded that everyone be on exactly the same page of the same textbook every day, and the teachers couldn't bring me in. And I'm from a rural town in Wisconsin, and it was a dairy society. I'm very good with cows. And I know my butterfat percentages. I know my breeds, all of that. And the thing was that we didn't have science as such in school. We had agriculture. And the idea that the teachers knew what they were teaching, they understood, they brought us out to different farms, we studied different techniques, we compared them, we argued about them, we debated them. This was in the sixth grade, but I was about 12 years old. And that sort of freedom of thought and the idea that you're not in a regimented education was a better preparation to be a NASA astrophysicist than I think today's California standardized education. The idea of flexibility, and I mean something that I've really fought against all my life is that I hated my physics education. I love astrophysics. The actual classes in math and physics were intimidating and frightening and confusing all the way through. From middle school to graduate school, didn't enjoy a single one. I love being an astronomer. There was no variation for how somebody learns for the diversity of personalities. I didn't learn well by intimidation, you know, the teacher challenging you, can you figure out this physics problem? You don't need to teach physics that way. There's nothing about the subject matter that dictated it be taught that way. So, I mean, those were some things that kind of stood in my way and things I would really like to see changed. It's hard. I mean, when teachers are paid so little and are so overworked, how can you expect them to be creative? How can you expect them to have different ways of learning with different students? Not only does the United States really have to get its act in gear with the social structure and with healthcare especially, but you know our education system right now is doing nothing but stymieing what the kids are thinking. So, I mean, I'll look if I can tee that off to my more education expert people.
Well, I guess I'll jump in and share a quick thought as a teacher. So how is the education system going to change, and how is the University of Colorado perhaps going to change, knowing that the gig economy is coming? Well, I think at the core is technology, right? These are our true digital natives, and so we still have some old-fashioned teaching styles of old-style PowerPoint and Sage on the stage and things like that. That absolutely has to go, and it's going to be much more engaging, practical, and applied. So, for example, we have a class, it's our venture planning class, where students can monetize their passion, they can create a business. And we just this last semester piloted a program where we invest in each one of these businesses. We give them $500, and they go, and their requirement is they have to have a return on investment. We had one team that returned about $7,000 on the $500 investment. So they learned and practically learned and applied the lessons of entrepreneurship and how to create value in the world. So I would suggest that certainly one thing that I'm observing that's going to have to change in education is even more practical, more applied, more real type experiences that aren't in a traditional room or classroom like this. I teach a program in the summer. It's a global internship program. This year, we're going to have 30 students working for startups in 17 countries around the world. And I run the class via video and email and, et cetera. So I think there's going to be more non-traditional four-wall classroom type experiences for our Gen Z generation. It's going to be much more integrated in with the day-to-day life, so to speak. So that's one thing I would suggest in terms of how the education system will have to change to cater to this new economy. Lux, go ahead.
Just to build off two of those, I think Michelle's really correct about standardized education being deeply problematic. One of the things that I see a lot is we have this idea of one thing for everybody. And so right now we're in a period where it's everybody should go to college, or everybody should not go to college. You have the Peter Thiel, college is useless, I'm just going to give you $100,000. And I think we need to focus a little bit more on the end goal that people have. I have written before for Quartz, actually, about how you shouldn't go to grad school was an argument. And it wasn't really you shouldn't go to grad school, because grad school can be great. But this idea of everyone should go to college, everyone should go to grad school, that's how you get the best life, is terrible. Because you should go to grad school because you have a career that requires going to grad school, because you've analyzed the cost-benefit analysis, because it's not going to put you into major debt. But if you're going to grad school to delay, or just to go to school, or because you think aimlessly that, I'll just be a better person, that's going to land you in debt and not necessarily gain you anything. Likewise, I think college, I think it's really unfortunate that we are in a society right now that says that you have to go to undergraduate college just to achieve a bare minimum of living wage and livable life. Like, I went to Columbia. I loved it. I am really happy I went to college. But I think there is an undervaluing of vocational education. There's an undervaluing of skills that you can get that don't require higher education. I think, we used to have vocational schools that would prepare you for a job, and when you were 18, you would go out into the workforce, and that would be fine, and you could have a stable job that you would have for your life. We don't have that anymore, and I think that now we have this idea, well, everybody has to go to college to do this, and you have a lot of people who are in debt and have worse outcomes. So I wish we had more valuing of a diverse array of skills. So academic is one kind of skill, practical, more another kind of skill, and that we would accept that people don't all have to go to the same path, and that there's not a hierarchy of paths. That, like, the fact that you have a PhD doesn't mean you're inherently better than someone who just did high school education and went into some kind of more creative or manufacturing work.
I have something to say here. I agree. You should not go to college just to go to college, but to go to get a degree that actually helps you get your life goal. But when high schoolers in my country ask me if they should go to college and they don't know what they want to do, I always say yes. Go at least for a year, because you will see so many different things, or you will get so many different subjects, and you will find something you want to do if you don't know yet. But there's a difference at taking a risk going to college in my country, because you do not have debt if you drop out after first year, or if you finish college. You do not have debt, because we do not pay for college. I mean, I did, because I did some different kind of college, but still. What?
Not a lot of money.
Yeah, $5,000. Yeah. It's nothing. And on the other hand, I also agreed with Eric. Colleges are too theoretical. If I say I studied education, so like I said, I did a bachelor, I have two masters, I was in college for 5 years, and the amount of knowledge I got in those 5 years is... it cannot be compared in the amount of knowledge I got in 1 year being an entrepreneur, because I was doing things practically, I was reading, and I was applying it directly to what I was doing. So the problem with college is it's too theoretical.
Yeah, and just to sum this up, to be very concrete for the young generation making life choices right now, I think there's two things that we need to be aware of. Number one, we need to ask ourselves what is the ultimate goal of education. And in my opinion, for this generation right now, is whether every individual will achieve financial emancipation or not. It's really that simple. And then out of that comes the second realization. What are the concrete and specific things that the school system is teaching in order to achieve that? Now, I love my philosophy classes, and I love to have discussions about all kinds of crazy things, including the black hole at the very end of the story. And this needs to happen, because this makes our life rich. However, just doing that is not going to be enough. So that means that every single college, every single high school for that matter, should teach kids about how to do their taxes, how to make money, how to sell the business. Beautiful example to do $500 and try something with it. And all of these life skills, which at the moment, I think the main reason they're not being taught is because the school system says it's the role of the parents to do this, whereas the parents believe the school system should do this, and the kid just ends up playing video games.
So we've got about 15 minutes left in our session here. I've got about 30 questions. I want to try something here. Let's do a quick round Q&A on some of these student questions. So we've got a lot of student questions that I want to tee up. And let's do, kind of 60-second thoughts on each of these questions. I know. We're going to ramp ourselves up. This one we may want to add maybe another 15 seconds to, because this one's pretty deep. But the question is from a student. Says, I'm a Gen Zer. I'd be curious to understand how can we create an economy that's not based on materialism, consumerism, but on a human-centric economy? Round of applause for the student that opposed that question.
I think first and foremost, we have to have a strong social safety net, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. if you need to separate your ability to live and exist from your ability to make money, and until we moderate or leave our capitalist model, we're not going to be at that. That's my quick version.
Fantastic, Lux.
I guess I'll jump in there. I mean, so one of the things I do is manage NASA's Earth Science programs and all the education outreach, and we're very aware of how quickly the climate's changing. There's going to be a massive economic shift in the lifetime of Generation Z people. And it's not something where, there's no use just simply crying and saying we're all going to die and there's nothing we can do about it. That is an incredibly privileged point of view. There are going to be people from third world countries who are dying as we speak who are going to figure it out. They're going to figure out technologies that are better. They're going to figure out ways to survive. Capitalism at this point, where simply you go for profit at any cost, is destroying the planet so much that we are going to make it unlivable in a couple hundred years. New York City is in its last century. It'll be underwater fairly soon. I mean, I know the data from the satellites, and I know what's going on. The Greenland ice sheet alone is losing 300 billion tons every year. That's not being replaced. In another 100 years, the Middle East will be unlivable. People will not be able to do the Hajj. They will not be able to go to Israel because we, in our NASA computer models, are expecting 170-degree temperature highs. Humans will not be able to survive in parts of our planet. You are going to have to adapt to this. We are not going to all die. We are going to adapt. We are going to figure this out. But money being the sole driver of what we do is done. We're just simply going to die if that's the case.
Wow. Yeah. Next one up, Mattia, why don't you tee this one up for us? Another very poignant question from a student. Can the Gen Z generation fix previous problems?
Okay. Climate change.
Whoever asked that question, first of all, kudos for, thinking about solutions, and that's really a good thing. My answer is absolutely yes, but in reality, I think what needs to happen is not a revolution and a change of systems, but what the young generation has done best since forever, which is to create parallel systems that basically do all the things that essentially the society should be doing. I think firmly that the generation today already has a parallel education system online where basically they do all the things that they're interested in. I think everyone agrees that there is a parallel media system available right now where vloggers are more relevant to the young generation than New York Times. What is a problem here is the fact that this young generation does not really have in their hands the means, the economic means, to pose a big influence on society and at large. How do we do climate change? How do we do this? How do we make this shift? Well, I hope that the young generation is going to do exactly what Karl Marx predicted the proletariat will do, but unite, rise up, and actually figure out that socialism has achieved its goal where everyone has, every worker has the means of production. What am I saying by that? Every one of you guys has a laptop. Every one of you guys has 3 or 4 hours of free time every day. This is more than enough for you to do serious damage if you decide to get shit in action. So go and do it.
Tiasha, anything to add to that? Since you're so close to this generation, do the millennials and the Gen Z, can they fix these previous problems?
I miss that generation only for 3 years. yes, I agree with the parallel system thing, because I think all the changes in the human history happened that way. There were some revolutionary things, but you don't go and do a revolution. You do some parallel system that will help you create something, and then it will expand. Like, I don't know, maybe tech startups are something that you're more familiar with, like Uber started, like Facebook started. It was a little thing, a parallel system that expand through a whole world. So this is something that we or you or everybody, not only Gen Z generation, because it affects everybody. We need to find a field we are good at, and we need to find a field that we care about and start making a system there and then start expanding it.
Fantastic. Thank you. So moving right along with our little quick series, Lux, here's a question to tee up for you to start, again from a student. Interesting. Do you think the older generation is preventing millennials and Gen Zs from making a true change? And if so, how might we be able to change that?
So, yeah, I absolutely do. I mean, if you look at Congress, and you see, like, there's a lot of excitement about, like, AOC and Ayanna Presley and Ilhan Omar and these young women who really represent the coming generation. They're not white, they're women, they're very leftist, and you see that they are being stymied and held back by people who do not want to give up power. We have a country, especially in our government, where we really reward seniority, and where older people are still holding on to power. But I think that there is the possibility to disrupt it. I think it's going to be really, really difficult. But one of the things that's really exciting that's happening in New York media, for instance, is the return of unionization. If you follow like New York Magazine writers just unionized, Vox has unionized, BuzzFeed is trying to unionize, freelancers like myself are trying to form unions. And I think that with collective power, we can stand up to the smaller, aging group of people who are still holding the reins. And also, go vote. Seriously, it matters. It's the only way that we're going to get more people like AOC in power.
Fantastic. Thanks, Lux. We have 4 minutes left, so that quick math. Each of you, 60 seconds to kind of share final thoughts. And a poignant question, again, from a student. To us Gen Zers, what two pieces of advice would you give to us as we chart our path in the world? Michelle, why don't you start us off?
two pieces of advice. Curate your own curiosity. I really think that a lot of people don't realize the power they have inside them when they get to decide what they like to do. And, you know, what advertising tells you should do, what the culture tells you should do, what the established, you know, academic environment, you can really bypass all of that. I mean, as I mentioned, I mean, why should I become an astrophysicist when I hated every class I ever took in physics? I loved it. I absolutely love being an astronomer. You can curate yourself. And sort of that self-knowledge of what you are good at and what you are not good at. For so long, I tried to kind of shoehorn myself into what I thought a scientist was supposed to be like, very detail-oriented, very logical, very linear, that my brain does not work that way. And so do not ask me to proofread anything. I suck at it. So, you know, when you realize what you're good at, and then you sort of embrace that, and you embrace what you're not so good at, like you were saying, not all of us are going to be super aggressive entrepreneurs. I don't have that personality. But I have contributions to make, and I have ways to exist in this new economy by actually embracing who I really am.
Fantastic. Thank you. Mattia. Yeah, Rob. Mattia.
So, picture you're living in a rural Slovenia in a post-socialist society where pretty much everyone in your town tries to move out because, you know, there's not really a lot of job prospects. And you need to find a way to nevertheless stay there because you kind of like it. So there was an 11-year-old kid who, together with his grandmother, would spend every fall in the woods, and they have in front of their house the oldest fir tree in the world. In other words, the oldest Christmas tree in the world. So with the grandmother, they would go, collect the cones, put the seeds into the small pots, and they would have a small garage production of children of the oldest Christmas tree in the world. Now imagine the potential of such a story. I truly, firmly believe that only a young person could come up with the idea that this could be sold. Now, we come to the luck part, where unless you have access to somebody who is an entrepreneur, you might end up selling those little trees in front of your house on a stall for $5 each. But if you are connected with somebody who has seen a little bit of the world, maybe that somebody could, just like it eventually happened, tell the little kid, send the email to Harrods. You know Harrods, the most famous store where the Queen of England buys stuff in London. So, if you would go to Harrods 2 years ago for Christmas season, you would find there a Slovenian product. The child of the oldest Christmas tree in the world, marketed as the most fancy Christmas tree ever, sold for £650 each. The moral of the story here is actually very simple. Youngsters, not so youngsters, but people who are young at heart, please always believe that you understand the world far better than the old fucks sitting in front of you. And with that being said, do not ever allow yourself to lose your hope. My dear friends, protect your courage. Work hard. Execute and get shit done, because I have full hope that you will create a better world that we have here today. Thank you so much.
Well said.
So I would say prioritize having enough over having the most. I think, again, with capitalism, we are in this society where we see we have to always be trying to extract as much wealth and screwing other people over and being the best because there can be only one. And that's a society that has created the mess that we're in. I'm not necessarily going to be the richest writer ever. I'm certainly not the most wealthy person among my friends. But I am able to pay my bills. I am able to live a life that I really enjoy. I love the work that I do, and I set my own schedule, and it's great. I mean, would I love to be a kajillionaire? Yeah, I mean, I would have a lot more freedom, but I have created a life where I'm happy, I'm content, and I'm doing what I love, and I'm not focusing on, like, are my friends making more? I'm just recognizing that being in a position where everyone is stable and everyone feels content is so much better than me being the king of Trash Mountain.
Well said. Thank you. Tiasha, last word.
Yep.
While I agree with everything said before, I want to add just one little thing that applies to you all, no matter what you want to do or what your goal is. Think big, start small, act now.
Woo-hoo. All right, with that, Tiasha, Lux, Mattia, Michelle, thank you so much for sharing this amazing insight, a peek into the future of the Gen Z economy. Thanks so much for attending, everybody. Have a great rest of the day.
Thanks.